Hey everyone, it's the Lady J. Thanks for tuning in once again to I Never Told You What I Do for a Living. This week, I'm joined by Adam. I'm not going to explain how Adam and I know one another because it's all in the podcast. Adam currently runs Pod Bible Magazine along with Stu Whiffen and Scroobius Pip and is a freelance graphic designer. His journey is a fun one and we have a good laugh together. I hope everyone enjoys episode 22 of I Never Told You What I Do for a Living with Adam, the freelancer. Okay, so I'm joined by Adam Richardson. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good. Are you feeling better? I know you had a cold before.
I'm feeling okay. Something I found out since having a child, I've got a four-year-old daughter now, is that you don't really get the chance to have that rest time where you can get fully better. So things tend to last a bit longer. But I don't want to start the podcast just moaning about my health. I'm good.
Okay, so let's then start the podcast the way that I always start these, which is by asking you, what is your earliest memory of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
My very earliest memory is wanting to be a fireman. I think literally I probably would have been about 5 or 6 years old, obviously playing with toys. I used to have a fire engine I used to like to play with. And I thought that was pretty achievable. Thought it was quite an exciting thing to do. I think I used to watch a show called Fireman Sam, which has since been rebooted over here and is now, I think it's terrible, but my daughter really enjoys it. And then that didn't last very long and I wanted to be a chef. Again, I think that was related to TV shows I used to watch. And then things progressed and I actually started to realize a little more that maybe I needed to think about what I was actually good at or interested in. Quite early on, I decided I wanted to do something creative and I wanted to be an illustrator. So you've got three answers there.
That's good. So did you have other creative people in your family or in your social sphere that you might have encountered at that age when you decided you wanted to be an illustrator?
Not really. I'm trying to think. I mean, no, my parents, they're not really creative at all. I'm not sure how they'd feel about me saying that. But yeah, it's not as if they'd be, you know, sat around doodling or, I mean, they're not musicians or anything like that. I've got an older brother and sister. Neither of them are particularly creative either. My dad's sister is quite flamboyant. So maybe there's a little bit from her, but no, not really. I just used to enjoy watching any sort of art programs. There's the program called Heartbeat or something like that. Things like Art Attack, all these shows. They're the kind of shows that I'd gravitate to where they sort of show examples of how to make things and then I'd want to do it myself. And it definitely wasn't the people around me.
Did you have encouragement though to pursue it?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I think from quite early, I was quite good at drawing. I mean, I realized quite soon that I was never going to be an illustrator in the sense that I'm not very good at drawing stuff from my brain. So if you said to me now, Adam, draw a picture of a horse, and then I sent it to you, you'd say, okay, now when are you going to send me the picture of the horse? Because I can't, unless I'm actually sat in front of something, I'm not particularly good at drawing things. But I mean sometimes I'd sit and I'd draw the house on the other side of the road, or I'd draw the car that was on the drive, and my mum and my dad would always sort of say, hey, that's pretty good, that I think, you know. And I imagine it's something I can see now, having a child, sometimes when they do something impressive you kind of latch onto that and you go, hey, maybe this is something that they could do in later life. And yeah, my mum always used to say to me, I think you could do this. I think you could do illustration or design or something arty. I did get the encouragement.
That's pretty great, because a passion for something like art, oftentimes you hear, my parents were like, get a real job, you know, like.
yeah, Yeah, no, that's true. I think sort of when I got to school age, I started really getting into art, and I had some good teachers. So this was secondary school. So from around 11 to 16, I had a couple of really good teachers, started getting a bit more into design stuff and sort of more structured design rather than the art side necessarily. And I think again, my parents could see that side of things, and as well as things like creative writing and anything that was creative, I was excelling at. Things like science, nope. Maths, nope. History, nope. But anything that I had to sort of think outside the box or get a load of pens and pencils out, I'd enjoy. And I think they saw that as well. Yeah, I was passionate about it. I enjoyed doing it. It didn't feel like a chore, whereas all the other homework definitely did.
And were you encouraged to pursue higher education?
Yes. It was quite... My parents didn't do any higher education. My brother and sister didn't either. They sort of finished college and then went straight into jobs. When it came to me deciding whether or not I was going to go to college and university, we were in a sort of a bit of a more comfortable state as a family, in the sense that my mum and dad were doing well enough to be able to sort of help me do it and go to university and leave home, and support me through it. So it was very much encouraged, and I was very keen to do it as well. I mean, I think at that age it was much more about the finding myself, the partying, the living away from the family more than what it was going to do for my career. But yeah, they encouraged me to do it.
I mean, I think a lot of people out there who have been to university would say that those aspects sometimes are more important in terms of what you actually take away from your experience at university, the things you find out about yourself, the interactions you have with other people, just the times when you screw it up and figure out how to make it work and all that kind of stuff, the problem solving you have to do just because you don't have mom and dad there to support you.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I think my brother was my best man at my wedding, and he's 9 years older than me. And one of the things I remember him saying is, yeah, how university, I left for university as a boy and I came back as a man. And I think it's so true, because I hadn't realized what a sheltered life I sort of lived before I went away and met all sorts of different characters. I mean, the schools that I went to as a kid were very white. I'm very straight as far as I was aware at that time. I was just dealing with pretty much people who are the same as me. Going away to university, meeting all kinds of different people from all different walks of life as well, definitely helped me develop and grow up.
Where did you go to university?
I went to Wolverhampton. It's not the first choice that I wanted. I wanted to go to Bournemouth, because they had a really good course. I mean, they're sort of quite well known for their digital media, sort of design and graphics and animation and that kind of thing. I did terribly in my A-levels, 16 to 18. I just wasn't interested and didn't do very well. The first time that I can kind of remember my parents being properly sort of disappointed in me and in how I'd done. And so I ended up having to go to the University of Wolverhampton, which isn't a bad university by any stretch, but it wasn't my first choice.
And what was the program that you studied while you were there?
I did digital media, which was supposed to be a mix of sort of graphic design, animation, and then also video production and editing and that kind of thing. I quickly realized that the animation side kind of wasn't for me. It was a little bit too tricky for me, a little bit too time consuming. And I thought I'd do a lot more of the graphic stuff, the design stuff, but I actually ended up falling more into the video production our first year. And this is mad, because honestly, I don't feel old, but when I say this, it makes me realize that, yeah, maybe I'm not quite as young as I think. Because of the first year at university, the videos that we were shooting on VHS cameras. So we'd have to take these huge cases out sticking a VHS tape, massive camera on our shoulders, film whatever it is we were filming, then lug it back to the studio, transfer, you know, digitize the VHS tape onto the edit suite and then edit it. And then second year, I think it moved to mini DV tapes. And then just as I graduated, I think they started going digital.
Just in time for, you know, you to not be there anymore. So
yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's strange. I didn't expect to do the video stuff, but I did kind of fall in love with it and ended up having a real passion for editing, and which is something that we'll get onto. And I'm sure, well, I mean, I don't know if it's a shared love. I don't know how you feel about editing your podcasts, but I really enjoy editing podcasts now, and any videos, home videos, audio files, if it's something for family, I really enjoy the process of editing. And that was definitely something that I learned about and fell in love with it at university.
I think a lot of people don't understand how creative you have to be a quality editor, regardless of what kind of editing it is. I find that this is the case for writing as well as for, I mean, I've never really done very much editing for video, but for audio, yes, that it's taking something that already is a thing, right? And then making it into something else, something a little different, making some changes to it. There's still a creative process there. Even when it's written, it's not just about moving commas and making sentences shorter, but also when you're choosing a different word for things, you change the voice, right? And so that is part of it as well. And I think a good editor has to be creative as well. So it doesn't surprise me that that's something that you found you had a passion for.
Yeah, totally. I love the fact now that I'm, you know, obviously I do a lot more audio stuff now, and it obviously is so much easier because basically I'm doing the same thing as I was at university, but not having to worry about any visuals, which is obviously, you know, a lot harder, I'd say, to edit than the audio stuff. But I think one thing you notice when you listen to a lot of podcasts is it is easy. I think a lot of people assume it's quite easy, but I think it's quite easy to spot bad editing or to spot lazy editing or quick editing, or and obviously the art to it is editing it so that people don't notice that it has been edited. And that's something that I'll notice in TV and when I'm watching films, you know, you'll notice bad editing. And quite often with the real pros, you don't notice at all. And that's, I guess, the aim.
And I think part of it too is to know how much editing is necessary.
That's true. Yeah.
I think about that all the time when people are talking. I think to myself, one of the things I think it's big in podcasting is how long of a pause can someone take in between phrases before the listener will think something is wrong with the audio? What is that magic space? And I have listened to empty space, like dead air, so many times to go, is this too long? Does this need to be shorter? Will people think that this person has expired or something? But they're being thoughtful, and I want to convey the fact that they're really considering, you know, they start a phrase and they stop and they begin again and then there's a deep pause. And, you know, do I leave the deep pause to convey what's actually happening in the way they're thinking in real time, or do I shorten it for the sake of the listener? True. And it's just kind of like, you know, the crunchy granola part of me is like, keep it real, man. And, you know, leave the pause in. Yeah. And the part of me that wants people to listen to the whole thing is like, cut it. So finding that balance is so hard.
Yeah. I edit. I do a lot of the editing for my sort of wrestling podcast that I do been doing for quite a while now. And when we first started it, I think basically we share the editing. We split it into three little chunks. So straight after the record, we each do say 20 minutes each. And I'd find that the other two guys were sending me their chunks really quickly after like half an hour, and I'd be sat there for an hour or so, really going through everything, removing any little chair squeak in the background, any sort of large breath, or there'd be bits where if somebody, say, stumbled over their words a bit, I'd cut out that stumbling, or I'd cut out the bit where they go, or they do a little tut, and I'd really overdo it. And then I'd listen back afterwards and I'd think, well, this just doesn't even sound natural. I mean, if we ever do a live show, people are going to have this expectation that we're going to be the most professional people ever who literally never make any mistakes. And two, it just sounds weird. It does just sound weird, but it is hard to sometimes decide how much to cut.
So let's go back a second to college. To university, and you decide that you want to get into video editing, right?
Yeah.
And where does that take you?
Well, so it took me to London. So I graduated in 2005, and I knew, basically we had a little group of us at uni on my course, and we all took different responsibilities. So we'd be making these videos. So we'd made little documentaries, we made magazine shows, we did a quiz show. It ended up being that I was pretty much always doing the editing. And so I thought, right, okay, this is it. This is something I want to do. I finally know what I want to do in life. This is going to be quite an exciting career. It means that I might be able to work in film or TV, something, you know, obviously industries that are appealing to work in when you're younger. So I thought I'm going to have to move to London. Obviously they've got a really good post-production scene and production scene down there in Soho. I applied to, I think, maybe about 20 different post-production companies for TV and film, and then got maybe 5 responses, opportunities to go and interview. And I went and had some interviews in London, and I was absolutely terrified. It just felt so grown up and real. And I'd grown up in a little village down south, in the south of England, near Brighton. Used to go up to London literally, you know, maybe if I was getting taken out to the theatre or to go and do something touristy. So it was still, you know, the big scary London to me. Went to have some interviews and did okay, did well. I remember I totally overdressed. I wore really, really smart clothes, got to these places and everybody was just wearing hoodies and t-shirts and things. ended up getting a job as a runner. So all these jobs I was applying for was as a runner. So, I mean, I used to think it would be helping out in the edit suites and doing all this kind of stuff, but it was just making tea and toast and filling fruit bowls and collecting people's lunches and all that kind of stuff. But I really, really enjoyed it. Ended up working for a TV post-production company who used to edit Top Gear and The Apprentice and some quite well-known shows. So we'd have people coming in, you know, names and celebrities that I recognized, and I found that exciting. That was really cool at that time. Did that for about 6 months or so before I got promoted to head runner. So less of the making tea, more of the telling other people to make tea. that was pretty much it. It meant I didn't have to do any night shifts anymore, because there was a lot of shift work in the early days. But head runner, you just did your standard 8 till 5 every day. It's still sort of hoping to get into editing. But what I found out was that to become an editor, to become a TV editor, it was going to take a long time. And it was going to take a long time of not earning very much money and doing a lot of shift work, sort of paying your dues, doing a lot of working in digitization and all this other sort of technical stuff, technical roles, for years before you maybe would get an edit assistant job. And then you'd do that for years before you then maybe get a junior editor role. And I sort of slowly realized that perhaps I wasn't quite as passionate about wanting to do that as I thought I was.
I'm going to go back for 1 second, because you said something at the beginning of this section where you're talking about when you were part of the team at university and you kept doing the editor role, right? That you said this phrase, you said, I thought this is it. This is what I want to do with my career. Did you feel a pressure when you were in university to come out of it with, this is now my job and I will do this job until I don't work anymore?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, I mean, I don't know if I felt pressure. That was just the expectation, I think, that we were all there at university doing courses which were going to decide the course of our careers. You know, everybody was going to be doing, they'd chosen their course, they were going to find the particular area that they liked and then they were going to go out and try and get a job in that field. I didn't feel any pressure, but I can sort of, you know, looking back with hindsight, I can sort of see how actually I could have had a bit more of an open mind, but I was happy with how it was going, and I thought I'd found the thing. And I mean, it shows that I still, as I said, I still love editing. So it definitely was a passion that I'd found, but it just, you know, it just turned out I wasn't actually going to be an editor in TV or film, which is fine.
At any point before you graduated from university, did anyone ever suggest to you that you might try more than one thing when it came to actually working?
Not that I can remember. I mean, maybe. I don't recall having those kind of conversations. It's weird. I don't really recall having many conversations about careers and what I was going to do and what I wanted to do. Or if I did, I obviously wasn't taking them very seriously or thinking them to be very important because they didn't leave a lasting impression.
So one of the things that's interesting to me about the like journey of this podcast, because I think at this point I've had, this is conversation 22, 23, is that, so we start off by asking a question about being a child and thinking about having to grow up and do a job of some kind. And a lot of those jobs tend to sort of live in the realm of Halloween costume, right?
Of course.
A thing that you might wear, a coat of some kind or a funny hat or something like that. And one of the things I think people sort of allude to is just the natural progression of things, that you go to school and then you pick a job and then you do the job and then you don't do a job anymore
and then
you die, I guess. I don't really, that seems to just be about as much information as anyone has. And I'm just always curious about whether or not anyone is being prepared in the way of like, well, you might do this job and then that job will stop for one reason or another. And then you'll do this job. And then maybe while you're doing this job, you'll develop a hobby. And then that hobby will become this other job. And then you leave the second job. Like, I feel like everyone has been exposed to that, whether they realize it or not, but nobody ever thinks that's the trajectory that they're going to follow. And so I'm always fascinated when people are like, I thought I found the thing. It wasn't the thing. And so I moved on to this other thing. And it's like, that's a lot more common than people think it is.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting because I guess if somebody had had that chat with me before I left uni and said, hey, you're going to go and do this, but it might not work out. And the chances are you're going to end up doing this or this. Perhaps that might have affected my motivation during that time trying to actually reach the goal that I'd set myself, because I might have been like, well, actually, you know, maybe sooner I may have thought this isn't for me, which is okay because I had that chat with that person who said that it might not be for me, so I'm going to back out. Or as soon as something got slightly more difficult, or perhaps, you know, things weren't going to be as easy as I'd expected, that maybe would have given me an excuse. I don't know. I've just thought of that. I don't know if that's necessarily true.
That is a very fascinating counter answer. I didn't think about that either, but I imagine that if that had been the case for me, that 100% would have been true. I think if someone was like, it's fine, something else will come along, I would be like, all right, well, then I'm out and I don't have to worry about it that much
anymore.
So good. So when you decided that you didn't want to wait 500 years to become an editor, what did you do? You were going to have to figure something else out, right?
Yeah. So as head runner, I was obviously telling people to make tea and telling people to make toast and, you know, criticizing how strong somebody's tea was compared to somebody else's and all this kind of stuff. And I definitely got over-involved and enjoyed it maybe a bit too much. And I think back now, and I'm sure some of the runners thought I was a bit of a job's worth and, you know, taking it a bit too seriously. But I don't know, it's something that sort of continued throughout my career, is wanting to, I was going to say that I'm almost answering this as if it's a job interview. I just realized I was about to try and sort of go down a route of talking about why I think I'm really good at particular things. But I sort of always try and think how the job that I've been given can be done better. At least that's always the way I've done things when I've been employed. I mean, we'll move on to, but I've been self employed now for about 6 years, so it's obviously very different. But when I was a head runner, I was always looking at ways of improving the ways that we were doing things, the way everything was set up, looking at shift patterns, looking at just the list of jobs we had to do throughout the day, looking at how they could be done better and that kind of stuff. And I think that got spotted, and I got given the opportunity to have a promotion into a role which was client services coordinator, which involved basically the post-production company ended up having four different buildings around Soho. And it was kind of coordinating all of the client services across all four buildings. So it was looking after, now it was looking after the head runners in each of those buildings. It was looking after the receptionists in each of those buildings. It was just looking at all the different processes, liaising with the senior staff, liaising with the producers of the TV shows and saying, you know, how could we make this a better client experience for you? It was a role that didn't exist. And they sort of said, we think you'd be good at this. Are you up for it? And I've realized that I was kind of moving further and further away from anything creative and anything technical and anything I'd learn in my degree, but I was still using skills that I was, you know, I knew I could do it and I was enjoying it. And I did that for maybe 1 year before I got made redundant because the company decided that they'd expanded a bit too quickly. They didn't need to have these four buildings and had to downsize. And then they realized this role that they'd made up for me, perhaps they could cope without it.
Yikes.
Which was an interesting time. Yeah. 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 It was, I mean, and that was kind of kickstarted a period which I imagine everybody has. It was a period where I then just went and got any kind of job I could. I ended up working for a recruitment agency who, whenever we have runners off sick, there was an agency I'd call to get freelance runners. So when I lost my job, I went to that agency and said, I've been made redundant. What opportunities are there? And they sort of said, well, there's nothing really at the moment. But because I knew them quite well, they offered me some work there, some admin work. And then that turned into them offering me a sort of recruitment assistant job. And then that ended up with me being a recruitment consultant with them for 3 years, which when I look back now on my, if I was to look at my CV, it's sort of like in my mind, it's a little bit of a blot. It's like a period where I'm not particularly proud of in terms of the work that I was doing because I just wasn't fulfilled. But I kind of feel like it had to happen. It was the only job I've had where it was like, go in 9 o'clock, do whatever I needed to do, leave at 5 o'clock, completely forget about it, and then go home and, you know, have a drink, play computer games, do whatever I wanted to do, you know, party, whatever. And yeah, it was a weird time. And it took those 3 years, the first sort of couple of years just coasting. Final year, I realized, no, this is not right. I've gone off track and I need to sort myself out.
So at the time that you were working in this job, you weren't doing any, like you didn't have a hobby or something that you were doing when you left work?
No, not really. Towards the end, I started doing some courses, some tutorials on the Adobe suite. So Photoshop and Illustrator, things that I'd kind of known how to use a little bit. And I'd used a bit at uni, but I started thinking, yeah, I need to start doing something creative again. But for the first couple of years, it was literally just, oh, this is cool. I've got a job. I mean, it was a good company. They were doing things a bit differently, and they did put me in charge of the creative division. So I was hiring creative people and designers and helping freelance designers and things like that. But I mean, there wasn't much creativity in the role itself.
So after 3 years, you're working towards something. You're taking these courses to brush up your skills on Adobe, which is very smart. And what were you hoping would come from that? Did you make a conscious decision to re-explore the graphic design side? Or was it just like these might be useful skills in whatever it is I decide to do next?
I think it was a hobby, and it was sort of I enjoy doing this, so why not do it? You know, but around that time, it was before WhatsApp and things like that. Me and my friends used to send a lot of emails. So we'd have these big group emails, and we used to put a lot of thought into them. We'd come up with, you know, games and challenges, and quite often I'd think, I could, you know, Photoshop some sort of image here, which would be really cool or fun. And I couldn't remember how to do it. So I think it started like that. I was like, if I could learn how to Photoshop my friend's head onto this ridiculous picture, this is going to make everybody laugh and that will be fun. And then I started realizing that, you know, potentially it's a good skill to have. Maybe I'll start doing some side projects. Maybe I could start doing some wedding invitation design for friends or family or whatever, that kind of thing. And then what actually happened was, and I think this is like one of the biggest sort of turning points in my career so far, definitely, and kind of in my life, is that I was doing this recruitment for design agencies, and I was meeting freelance designers. And one day this guy came in, and he was a bit older than most of the other freelancers that I had on my books that I was sort of sending to different companies. I think he was like mid 30s or something, and everybody else was sort of early 20s. And his name was Richard Gladman, and he lived in Brighton, and I have met him since. But he was telling me, we were going through his CV, and he'd spent ages doing jobs that he wasn't particularly into, and then just decided to sort of jack it all in and just become a designer. He just taught himself, he did loads of courses, and he said, I'm just going to do it. And I remember meeting him on that day. I think we got him some work, but I remember going back to my desk afterwards and thinking, hang on a minute, I mean, if he can do it, then why can't I do it? Sure. I mean, I could do that. And I honestly, I'd got better at my design stuff. I'd been doing various bits and bobs. I had started doing a couple of sort of paid on the side projects for people. And I'd started meeting these freelance designers who I was sending out to places, and they were getting paid a lot of money, but they were doing work I was looking at, and I was thinking, I think I could do that. Or in a lot of cases, I was thinking, I think I could do better than that. So I then basically decided that I've just got to do it. I started out wanting to do this creative route, do editing. Fell by the wayside. I've now been doing recruitment for 3 years. This is not what I wanted. I'm just going to bite the bullet and go for it. And I knew that I was going to have to retrain, you know, start at the bottom potentially. So I went home and had, quite a big chat with my fiance. Was she my fiance then? Yeah, I think we weren't married then.
And she was supportive, I assume, based on the way this conversation is going. She said,
she said, no, absolutely no chance. So I still work in recruitment. I owe a huge amount to her when it comes to things like this. And even again, when it comes to what I'm doing nowadays, she said, yeah, you know, you're clearly not happy in what you've been doing. You clearly love doing your design work. I can see that you've been passionate enough to start doing these courses in the evening. Let's do it. Let's figure out a way. And we're in a good position where she had a good job in London. She was earning enough to be able to sort of cover things for us so that I could then start sending out CVs and cover letters to loads of design agencies. And we decided, we'd been in London for 6 years, living there for that time. We decided we wanted to move down to Brighton. She's from the Midlands originally. We met at university. She fell in love with Brighton when I'd taken her down there. We decided we wanted to move to Brighton. So I started applying to lots of different companies in Brighton and basically just saying, hi, as you can see from my CV, I don't have any relevant experience, but my degree's relevant and I've started teaching myself. Please, can I have a job literally doing anything? I'll be your receptionist. I'll be your office manager. I'll be an intern, whatever it takes. And I got one interview. And I got offered a job as well. I mean, it was a 6-month internship being paid pretty much nothing. And I don't even know if it's actually allowed, the amount that they paid me. We did it. Yeah. We moved to Brighton and we did it. And it was great. It was really great. And it sort of changed everything.
I think it's funny. The last conversation that I had was with my friend Anthony, who was, before you, the very first parent on this podcast.
Okay.
And one of the things that Anthony spoke about, and also my friend Meg, who was a couple of episodes ago, is how important a supportive partner can be when it comes to deciding whether or not you're going to leave a position or continue something, because obviously you have to make your decisions together because you've built your life together. And so I think it's great that your fiance at the time was like, fuck it, just whatever. Yeah. We can manage. So you're clearly not happy. Let's figure out a way to change that.
Yeah, totally. And she's done it again since. You know, I basically got to the stage where I was doing well again within design, and then kind of decided that I wanted to make another big change since then. And she has sort of backed me again. So I very much feel that at some point soon, I need to give her, I mean, and we're approaching this, you know, we're thinking about different career changes for her at the moment. And I'm basically, you know, I'm saying to her, you do exactly what you like, because you've given me so many different opportunities to pursue what I want to do. So, you know, if you decide that you want to just go and work in the pet shop around the corner for £12 an hour, then we'll find a way to make that work.
Oh my God, I would love to be surrounded by all those dogs all the time. That sounds...
I know. Yeah, I think her dream would actually be to go and work for the RSPCA in the cat area and just look after all the cats that come in.
So after you got paid no money to do an internship, where did your design career trajectory take you next?
Well, the cool thing about that job was I went in and immediately I had... So I was so happy and I was so sort of amazed that I was doing it. I was so grateful. That's the word I was trying to pluck out of the sky then. I was so grateful to be having that opportunity. Luckily it played the right way with my colleagues, because they could have just seen me as some annoying, enthusiastic person. But a lot of them were sort of graduates. So they graduated in design. They'd got their job in design because that's what they thought they were going to have to do. And they were a little bit miserable. They were just treating it as a job. They were like, okay, here we go. Come here. I'll do this design work. And then I'll get out of here and I'll go and do what I actually want to do in the evenings. Whereas I was like, guys, I've just spent 3 years doing stuff I do not want to do. And it made me miserable and it was rubbish. And now I'm doing this and this is amazing. Look what we're doing. And we were lucky enough to be working on we made games in this agency that I worked for in Brighton. We made games for Lego. So we were working on really cool projects, Lego superheroes, Lego Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, making these little mini games. We had to come up with them ourselves and then create them. And I kept on reminding them, saying, do you believe that we're actually doing this? So I was just on top of the world. And then after, you know, a few months, then the shine sort of wears off slightly and you realize, hold on, there are bits about any job, particularly when you're working in an office with other people, things can start to grind you down a little bit. After a little while, I started realizing that my experience in previous jobs, particularly when I'd been doing all the client services things and getting a knowledge of businesses and facilities and how things work, I realized that there were ways that I thought we could improve the agency that I was at, but didn't really have the opportunity to do that because my job was just designer. And I realized that maybe the way to go, now I've got the experience, now I've built myself a portfolio of work, and I've learned a load of skills, maybe it's time to go and do this by myself. You know, thinking about that guy, Richard Gladman, who'd inspired me so much, looking at his portfolio, looking and contacting other freelance designers, speaking to them, I realized that, yeah, this is the next step. So I had a couple of years at that agency and then I went freelance. So I sat down again with my wife and said, you know, this, you know, secure money we've got coming in now, I think I'd like to ditch that and start my own business. And she said, yeah, go for it. So I did. I went freelance, started working from home, started contacting all sorts of different clients, managed to speak to a couple of my old clients from the agency, and got some work. And then that's been it until now, really. Obviously the last year or so has been a little bit different with some of the podcast stuff I've been doing, but yeah, I am still a freelance designer.
Is freelancing stressful?
I was gonna say yes, but I think I've had it pretty good. I think there are stressful times, but because every time you're working, you're doing it for you, you're not doing it for the company that you're employed by, it kind of is always worthwhile. So I mean, quite often I'll work evenings or I'll do weekend work, but everything I put into it, I then get out of it myself as well, if you know what I mean. So I really don't have the stress that I used to have when I was working for a company, for an agency. Because so often I'd do something and then that would go up the line to the next chain of command and they'd say, no, let's do it slightly differently. And then somebody else would tweak it. And so, you know, you get all these different people getting involved. And as a freelancer, I have a client, they give me a brief. I do the work, I send it to them. If they're happy, amazing. If they want some changes, then I'll do them. And then that's that. And then I move on to the next thing. So I think I've been lucky. I don't tend to have that much stress.
That's pretty great. I think I would be concerned about making sure, well, because there is a certain aspect of freelance that comes with, you need to be a good salesman, right? Because you have to get yourself out there somehow.
That's true. Yeah, that is very true. I mean, I should sort of caveat this. I mean, I've said that I've been doing it for, how long did I say I've been doing it for? It's about six years now, but I've got a four-year-old. So In a way, I did it properly for 2 years, and then we decided to have a baby, and we had the baby, and then I was so lucky in the fact that I was freelance, because it meant that I could take off. I mean, I took off 2 months at the start. I got a really good contract just before the baby arrived. Very lucky, but it was a good contract. It paid well, and it meant that I could save some money to be able to take off 2 months. And then I would just be working 3 days a week when I first got back. Then when my wife went back to work, I basically would do all of the nursery drop-offs, pickups, cooking the dinner, all the washing, all the cleaning, kind of, you know, like some people would call it a house husband or whatever you'd like to call it. And that has kind of continued up until the Pod Bible stuff, which has got me a lot busier. So yeah, it's not like I am dependent on working 5 days a week, bringing in, you know, as much money as I possibly can. It's kind of, for the last 4 years, it's almost been part-time freelance designer, part-time dad.
And then that, of course, as your daughter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Daughter? As your daughter gets older and then school becomes a more regular part of mm-hmm. her life, then that will free up the amount of time that you have, because she's at school from whatever, 8 to 2 or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, even now she goes to nursery 3 days a week. I work 4 days a week and my wife works 4 days a week. So
okay.
On the Thursday, I'm with my daughter all day. And on the Friday, Hannah is with her all day. And I mean, that's great. And we totally realize how lucky we are to be in that situation where we're not having to put her into nursery every day and we can be around. But yeah, when she's at school, that will definitely free up some more time. She'll finish earlier than she does at nursery, but there'll be ways around it. And yeah, it'll be another time where I think it'll be sort of both of us reevaluating our careers and what we're doing and what we want to be doing.
It's funny. There is a version of the story I think I've heard somewhere else. Maybe, okay. I feel like maybe from Pip talking about you on a podcast or something like that.
Okay.
That you doing design work is how you got involved
with
the podcast stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think, I think we talked about that when we had the, when Stu and I were on Distraction Pieces doing a little bit of
that's right
promo for the live shows that we had. So, yeah, I mean, obviously been a fan of Pip's for a while.
You don't have to say nice things about him on this.
No, I know. Just please. You know, we're talking about our love for editing. Please really enjoy editing that bit out. No, it's cool. You can keep it in. Okay. I was aware of Scroobius Pip.
I'm going to cut right to that exact. You left me a nice pause there. I'm going to jump right there. Good.
Perfect. Yeah. So I knew of him. I followed him on Twitter and then obviously became sort of aware of Stu Whiffen, who one of Pip's friends and obviously somebody who was initially appeared on some of his podcasts and then got a podcast himself. Later, Dr. Susie Gage obviously had appeared on Pip's podcast and decided to start her own podcast. And that is kind of where it began, because Susie put out some artwork on Twitter for her podcast. She said, "All right, I'm doing it. I'm starting the podcast. Here's the artwork." And I saw it and I thought, it's good. It's good. But this podcast is such a great idea. And I just feel like I could offer something a bit better. Like, it seemed as if perhaps somebody had just done something really quickly in whatever software they had. I wasn't looking at it in a really snobby, designy way and just thinking that's terrible. I just thought I'd like to sort of reach out and offer to help. So I did. I messaged Susie and just said, "Hello, you know, I'm a fan of Pip's podcast. I heard you on it and I love the idea of yours. And can I possibly do your artwork?" And it turned out that I think her partner had whipped it together and she was like, "Yeah, sure, go for it." So I did. I put something together for her, which she uses. And then that led to other opportunities. So Jason Reed, who's also on the Distraction Pieces Network, he had a podcast coming out and Pip said, "You know, why don't you get in touch with Adam? Because he'll do it for you." And at this stage, it was all, I was doing it for free. You know, I was just doing it for fun. It was like, I always saw it as sort of a payback for all the free entertainment and content that I'd got from those guys in the past. Mm-hmm. It's completely changed now, of course. If any of them ask me for anything, then I'm sort of like, "Yeah, how much? Or what are you going to give me for it?" But back in the day, it was sort of like, "Oh, this is great. How exciting. I'm making podcast artwork that's going to be on the internet and other people are going to see this on their phones. And this is really exciting." So I did Jason's and then a little while without anything. And then Stu Whiffen did his podcast Off the Beaten Track. He did his own artwork. And again, I got in touch and I just said, that's not great. I'd like to offer to do that for you. And again, you know, seeing it from the other side now, you get somebody keen. It's like, "Hey, can I do what you've done better, but for free?" Then of course you're going to say yes. So I did, I did that for Stu. And then I did a couple of other things for Pip. He's had a couple of small projects where he's needed some design help or just some Photoshop stuff. And then it all went quiet. And then towards the end of 2018, I got a message from Stu saying he had something he wanted to run by me and could he call me? And he called and he said he had had this idea for Pod Bible. He had this idea that he wanted to release a magazine that promoted podcasts, reviewed podcasts, recommended podcasts, spoke to podcasters, all as a way to help promote his podcast and other, you know, podcasts that he was involved in. And I said, yes, I thought it sounded cool. And I just thought it was going to be another freelance project, another thing that I'd do every so often, potentially every, one day a week, I'd do a little bit of work on that and keep up all my other clients. And it slowly escalated into something which I'm pretty much doing full time now, which is mad.
That is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I ended up going for a meeting. I didn't. We didn't meet for ages. We just sent emails back and forth. I said that I'd come up with a template, an idea, some designs for the layout of the magazine. We went back and forth on ideas for different features that we'd have in there. And then after a couple of months, I went up to London, met those guys with printouts of the designs I'd done. They were happy. And Stu sort of took on the role of trying to do some sales and get some advertisers and get some partners involved. Pip, obviously, you know, had some really great contacts in the podcasting world, but also in entertainment. So we knew we could get some well-known names involved as well to people to interview. He got Adam Buxton as the first sort of main guest in the magazine, which is obviously a great start. And it just grew from there. We kept on having more ideas of things that we wanted to add to the magazine. We kept on having new podcasts that we'd hear that we'd want to get involved. And it just continues to escalate, and so much so. I mean, Stu is such a massive ideas man that he's constantly coming up with stuff on our WhatsApp group, and often we're sort of having to rein him in a little bit and say, hey, you know what we've done, you know what we've achieved so far, that's pretty good, let's sort of level out a little bit and take a deep breath and then maybe look at these other things later. But it's really good fun, it's really exciting, and the way it's grown is pretty crazy. And we've got some good people involved, some good writers involved.
I don't know what you're talking about. Because I never tell people what I do for a living. Remember what the name of the podcast is.
So okay.
I'm not here to talk about me, except the times when I insist on talking about me. Anyway, so when did you start doing your own podcast, though?
So I've got the, Hardest Part of the Ring is a wrestling podcast.
This is very important because apparently I've blacked out this part of our interaction as people. And so I need you to fill in what happened while I was in some kind of wrestling drunk stupor and just missed this whole thing.
Okay, so a brief catch up on how it started. When I was at that design agency where I was an intern, there are a lot of guys there who liked wrestling. I used to like it when I was a kid, had no interest after I was about 10 or something like that. But I started getting back into it. They were talking about it, and a couple of them had little figures of Bret the Hitman Hart and all this kind of stuff on their desks. And I was thinking,
when was this?
This was 2012, something like that.
Okay, that's about the time I got back into wrestling. So that kind of, I feel like it was getting cool again.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, of course. We wouldn't have got back into it any other time. So we started talking about it and we started watching it. And then we started, they were watching it. I started watching it. Then we started getting together to watch pay-per-views and various different events. And we had initially a Skype chat, but just like a Skype text chat at work. And we'd just be texting, writing loads of messages about wrestling and what had happened on Raw or whatever it was. Didn't watch any independent wrestling at that time. Was just watching WWE again, because that was obviously the most accessible thing. And we joked about the idea of recording a podcast, because we started getting into podcasts. We used to listen to a lot of football ones and other sports ones, and we'd noticed that there were wrestling ones around. Joked about it for quite a while, and then suddenly one of us just, I can't remember who it was, but one of us just said, should we just do it? Should we just give it a go? And we all went on Amazon, bought the same £50 microphone. We thought if we all had the same mic, then at least we should all sound the same. We knew we weren't going to be able to record together because we all lived quite far away at that stage. And by then we'd actually left. I'd left the company and we'd all moved on. So we all record remotely. We record reviews of pay-per-views. We do quizzes. We do top five lists. We do the occasional interview. We did a few at the start. We haven't done any for ages. So we had Hardest Part of the Ring, which is the name of the podcast. And when it first started, we were trying to get people to listen to it. And as you know, that is quite a tough thing when you've got a brand new podcast and you don't have a big brand or, you know, a big company helping you spread the word. And so one of the things I did was obviously set up the Twitter account and started following existing wrestling podcasts and existing wrestling fans and bloggers. And I found you because you were podcasting. I can't remember what your podcast was called.
Face Lock Feministas.
There we go. Sorry. I should
have
remembered.
No, it's fine. I'm trying very hard to block it out of my head, actually. So
okay. Well, the key thing was that I think at one point you did an episode, or maybe you did a string of episodes, I don't know, but you did an episode about Riptide Wrestling, or at least you mentioned Riptide, which is obviously the promotion in Brighton.
We reviewed Blackwater. That was the one that we did. Yeah, because I remember the poster had, they blacked out everybody's eyes, and I just thought that was really cool. And then we connected with Josh, and he sent us that after it was on their video on demand. He sent us a link to it, and we watched it. And Courtney and I were like, "What the fuck is this? This is so different than anything else."
Yeah, oh man, that's cool that Josh did that. I didn't realize that's how you'd ended up seeing it. That's cool. So I thought I'd get in touch with you guys, and I did. I think I can't remember if I emailed you or I sent you a tweet, but it's one of those. And I sort of said, you know, really enthusiastic new podcaster, hey, you know, I heard you guys talking about Riptide. Well, that's our local promotion. And we just interviewed Josh. One of the very first interviews that I think he did on a podcast. And so at the time, it was like a little bit of a scoop for us. And we got loads of listeners, so many more listeners to that episode than we had to any of the others that we'd done so far. And I said to you, you know, this might be of interest. I've seen you've spoken about Riptide. Here you go. And I think you've replied, and I think it was an email actually. And I think you went, oh, cool, that's really great. Yeah, I'll give it a listen. I'll check it out. Thanks. And then I think that was it. And then, fast forward however many years, we've been talking about various other things through Pip and then through Pod Bible. And then I reminded you of this a couple of weeks ago and you were shocked.
I felt terrible because I have no recollection of this at all. You know what? It's funny because I find the intersection of wrestling and podcasts to be a very weird part of the internet and the world. It's a very strange community. And so I was particularly horrified to think that we had crossed paths and I had no recollection of it.
Do you know what's even stranger is I can actually, I remember, I think maybe it was the first I don't know which Riptide show it was. One of the first I went to, you were there. Now this is weird because I don't want to freak you out now. Okay. Cause this sounds really strange, but you were there with Susie. You're doing the
PW Girl Gym. Yeah.
And so you, I remember obviously because I was trying to grow our podcast. So I was sort of I was doing a lot of stuff on Twitter and I was getting to see people who were going to shows and I was recognizing people from their profile photos. So I went there and I saw you standing at, behind the merch table. And I thought, no, that's not her because she lives in America and this, you know, this is Brighton. This is weird. Why would you be here? But yeah, I didn't speak to her or anything, but I do remember seeing you there. But yeah, that is mad. I mean, I loved it. I absolutely loved it in those early days at Riptide with the podcast, especially because we'd done the interview with Josh and the opportunities that we'd got from that and then going to the shows and being able to, you know, speak to Josh and him giving us opportunities to, you know, come early, stay late or whatever and speak to him about how stuff worked behind the scenes. It was all really, really exciting. And unfortunately things over the last few months have been a little bit crazy and I've just been really busy and I haven't been watching as much wrestling. I haven't been going to as many shows and I've sort of haven't been in touch with the Riptide guys as much as I would have liked to have been, but hopefully that's gonna build up again soon. But yeah, I guess you never listened to that episode, right?
No, but I've listened to other episodes since then. So embarrassing. Oh god,
that's okay. To be honest with you, now I mean obviously working in Pod Bible, we get a lot of people approaching us saying, you know, we have a new podcast, would you check it out for me? And in the early days I did, and now I still try to. A lot of it depends on the kind of approach that they take. If it's just like, here's my new podcast with a link, then I probably won't. But if they make the effort to drop an email with a bit of information and you know, if they're polite and friendly, then I will try and check it out. But I know what that's like when you receive things just cold and it's just like, here's this, please tell me what you think.
I think not really, don't mean to talk about me, but that used to happen a lot, and my thought process was pretty much like, I think you're talking to the wrong person, mostly because I've never been terribly confident in my editing skills. Like when I started this podcast, now talk about somebody who gave really good advice. I actually reached out to Buddy Peace.
Okay.
And yeah. I said, you know, I studied, you know, I was part of the radio station and stuff like that in high school and college. That's where my audio production skills come from. But I've basically been doing it the same way for the last 10 years. Like, do you have any suggestions? And he's very easy to talk to and so pretty easy. Positive.
Yeah.
And he gave really good advice. And the stuff that he writes about in Pod Bible is, I feel like it's all, it seems very obvious, but at the same time, sometimes you just need somebody who's already doing it to say it to you before you're like, oh, that actually makes a lot of practical sense. And mm-hmm. that was incredibly helpful. And then when the first episode went live, I was like, if you have time to listen to this and just tell me what you think, am I on the right path or not? That's fine. Or even if you're just like, hey, sounds good, that's also fine. Like, I would like to know that someone's like, oh God, this sounds terrible. Like, you know, so that I can take it down and not be embarrassed by it. But I think, do you feel like you have mentors, or are you just winging it right now? Because Pod Bible and all these different things, there really isn't anything like it.
No, I very much have mentors when it comes to design stuff. I had a great relationship with the sort of lead or creative director there, who left at the same time as me. So he mm-hmm. went freelance, set up a business. We used to do a lot of work together. And when you're working by yourself, a lot of the time, when I was in the agency, you used to be able to, you know, literally say to the person next to you, what do you think of this? And when you're working at home alone, you don't get to do that. So I've got a good relationship with him where we'll send stuff over email or Skype or whatever. When it comes to the Pod Bible stuff, no, I mean, it's just, I think I've got a lot more confidence now in myself than I did, obviously, having done the freelance stuff for so long, having worked with so many different types of client. I think I've got a lot more confidence. And we are kind of winging it, but it's, I think what a lot of people have said to us since we started Pod Bible is that it, wow, you know, this is mad that it's taken this long for this kind of thing to happen, because it is such a simple idea. You know, it's, people are kind of crying out for it in a way. A lot of people are listening to podcasts now, but people don't really know how to find out about good ones unless it's word of mouth or they're just linked to one on their podcast homepage or something like that. There are obviously great newspapers that do amazing columns all about podcasts, and there'll be magazines that have a column all about podcasts, and there are websites devoted to it. But there was just no sort of thing in its entirety that was devoted to it. Something handy and small that we could give to somebody when they're walking into the tube, they'd slip into their pocket and then they'd find it on their way home and be able to sort of skip through and find some recommendations. So yeah, it's mentor wise, I'm not going to say that Pip and Stu are a mentor. If anything, I'm probably a mentor to them. I'm just saying that because if they've listened this far, then I think they deserve a little bit of a ribbing. But yeah, it's we're just winging it. It's the three of us. We're doing it. I say it's the three of us. We have expanded. We do have people who are helping us in different areas. Initially, it was a whole lot of work. I was doing an awful lot of it. Personally, I found myself sort of taking on more and more things, and we've started to sort of spread the load a little bit. We've got Buddy Peace helping in different areas. We have you helping in a couple of little areas. We've got a guy called Joe. And what we really want to be able to do is obviously grow it, make money from it, a good amount of money, so that we can take on people in more. I don't think we'll ever sort of take on permanent employees, but be able to offer people sort of a decent, you know, give people freelance work, basically.
That sounds pretty cool. I'm going to wrap up because we've already been talking longer than I meant to.
Yes.
But we had to do that section where I get embarrassed about not remembering you from 3 years ago.
We had to do that. That's cool. It's been great. It's been really good.
So now that we've kind of traced this trajectory of your career, what do you think would be important for someone who's listening to this episode to take away from it?
Wow.
No pressure.
What you need is, you need to find a partner who is willing to let you do whatever you want, whenever you want, and can support you financially. no, obviously, I mean, that's a huge thing. I really know I've been extremely lucky. I've worked hard. Don't get me wrong. I've worked hard at things, and I've tried my best to follow the things that I wanted to do, and obviously later in life with the design and the podcast stuff. But I have been very, very lucky that my wife's chosen career, and who knows, maybe one day you'll end up discussing that with her, but I'm very lucky that her career was a stable enough one, and one that made us as a unit enough money for me to be able to take these opportunities. So that isn't particularly helpful for anyone listening. Maybe just the period that we spoke about, where I was doing the tutorials and I was doing the courses, the world we live in now, on YouTube, you can literally learn anything. There are courses on Adobe that would cost you £700 and you'd have to do them 4 nights a week for 6 months. But there are also thousands of free videos on there from good people who know what they're talking about that can show you how to do everything. There are free trials for software. There are opportunities to learn stuff. There are alternatives to Photoshop. There are free alternatives out there that you can use. So if it's something that you've thought about doing and you think, there's too much in the way, that there really isn't. You just need to take 2 hours at a weekend, sit down and have a look, and you'll probably be quite surprised. And that can spread to anything. It doesn't have to be design. It could be cooking, could be engineering, could be being a fireman, could be being a chef, who knows.
I think something else too that has come up on this podcast before, mm-hmm. and something that I always try to sort of recenter myself on when I'm thinking about this in terms of freelance work, is that everyone is entitled to set their own boundaries for when it's time to move from, sure, I'd be happy to do that for you for the experience, and when, I'm going to die of exposure kind of thing. And I think I know you were kidding around, but you also said you went from, sure, I'm happy to, work on this, the graphics for your podcast for free because I like what you guys are doing and all that kind of stuff. And now it's like, no, I need to be compensated for the work that I'm putting in. And your story too is great because you've built a relationship with Pip and with Stu and with Susie and all these things. And now that relationship, there's a respect aspect to it. And it's not like if you keep doing things for free, people will expect you to do it for free forever. It's kind of like the more work you do, the more you need to be compensated. And anybody who's worth their weight in salt will recognize that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so true. I feel like we could easily chat for another hour about just that subject. And don't worry, I'm not going to now start an hour long monologue about it. But I think that there are people out there and there are designers who I've respected and I've followed on social media who I had to unfollow because of their attitudes toward this kind of thing, because they you get some who sort of say, never work for free, never ever accept a job where they say, this will give you good exposure. And I do understand that, because there are people who take advantage of young, enthusiastic people who will take on that work. But a lot of the opportunities that I've got in life have been because I've offered to do something for free as getting my foot in the door and having that small chance to just show these people that I am worth being given the work and being paid for it or being compensated for it and building that trust. And I think a big thing that Pip said in that Distraction Pieces podcast that I was on that I remember is him sort of saying, we could probably have found all sorts of designers who were incredible, who would have been able to do work for us and we could have paid them the money. But the fact that Adam had done those things for us, and I did the Films to Be Buried With artwork as well, which I didn't mention, the fact that I'd done all those different things meant that they knew that they could trust me and they knew I was reliable. And when it comes to putting together a magazine every 2 months, in many ways, the reliability is more important than the design skills in a way. It's an interesting one on that. I think case by case basis, basically.
But I think it's like the perfect marriage of those things, because it is an instance in which you want to prove yourself, and you've proved, and like you said, what Pip said on the podcast sort of validates that. But at the same time, what you said about Susie's podcast, I think is almost more important in a certain aspect, that you specifically chose something that what you thought was important. You didn't just say like, oh, well, Pip's famous, so I'm going to get in touch with him. It was Susie's podcast spoke to you in a way, and you wanted the artwork she was going to have to represent how important the topic was that she was going to be discussing. Yeah. And that is, I think, where if I was going to give advice to someone else, I would say that's where the line should be drawn. Don't do things for free that you don't believe in, you know, like do things for free that you think the just having them done well is enough compensation, you know?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. That's great. I'll do all the talking and you can summarize perfectly. I totally agree with you. But I guess, we'll have a chat another time, but I guess that's a real advantage of having, you know, what did you say, 20 different chats like this now, is sort of really getting to grips with people's experiences and sort of understanding paths people are taking and then being able to come up with a nice evaluation at the end.
I'm hoping that by the end of this, I'll actually have a degree in psychology. That's
yeah. Yeah.
All right. So cool. let's do your quick summary. Where can people find Pod Bible and Pod Bible adjacent things on the internet?
Okay. This is easy because we do all this at the end of the Pod Bible podcast. But Pod Bible, you can read the magazine, which comes out every 2 months. You can read it at podbiblemag.com. You can read it digitally or you can have it ordered to your door. No matter where you live in the world, we will send it out to you. You can also subscribe to the newsletter on there, which will mean that the magazine's sent to you on release day or there or thereabouts. We're working that out at the moment. We are at Pod Bible on social media. We have the Pod Bible podcast, which comes out once a week, which is hosted by me and Stu and occasionally Pip. Where we talk to podcasters about their podcast and podcasts that they like listening to. And I think that is it. Yeah. Just Google Pod Bible. You'll find us.
It's great. By the time this episode comes out, you will have already released I think it's the seventh, right?
Yes.
Seventh issue of Pod Bible.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Mm-hmm. And then if you so choose, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at My Name Is Ad, which is one of those things which when I've signed up to Twitter, I got the handle My Name Is Ad, and I am now sick of it. But I started my freelance business and I thought, what shall I call it? And I called it My Name Is Ad Limited. And now my website is mynameisad.co.uk, and it's just too much work to change. So My Name Is Ad is what you need to search. And you will find me and my social media and all that kind of stuff.
And the hardest part of the ring.
Hardest part of the ring. Yeah. Google hardest part of the ring. You'll find the podcast. Obviously search for it on all the normal platforms. And on Twitter, we are hardest part pod. And on Instagram as well.
And yeah, check it out. It is good. I've listened to it since Adam reached out to me, and it is great. I particularly loved the live episode you did with Matt and the hardest part of the jaw. It just made me laugh that
that was wild. Yeah.
Marrying of the names was fun. And I do love a good quiz. And I was screaming at my computer the answer to the Progress Tag Team Champions. I couldn't believe he couldn't remember the answers. That was just embarrassing.
Yeah, that was funny. If you want to see how much of a shambles our podcast is, then that is quite a good example, because we had a few errors in there. But Eddie Dennis made it very, very funny. So yeah, that's a good one. Good one to check out.
Anyway, thanks, Adam, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Was a lot of fun. And I release you into the wild now. You are free to go to bed, right? I guess is where you're.
Yeah, exactly.
Very late there now.
It is. My daughter will no doubt be up in about 5 hours or something ridiculous.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
No, yeah, it's not please. That bad. It's not that bad. But thank you. Thanks so much for the opportunity. It's really great to, it's good to reflect sometimes, isn't it? So it's been great to sort of sit down and talk about it all. And you've been a great host. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, lesson learned there. Always be gracious and kind whenever you can, because Someone asking you for help may want you to write for their magazine one day. Thank you very much to Adam for not making me feel too bad and for bringing me on to work on the Pod Bible stuff. It's been a lot of fun. Make sure you check out issue 7 of the Pod Bible magazine and every weekly episode of the Pod Bible podcast. They come out on Mondays and you can find them on whatever your chosen podcast streaming service is. If you are so inclined, you can follow me on Twitter @TheLadyJSays and on Instagram @TheLadyJSlays. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you consume your audio-based content so you never miss an episode, as you certainly will not want to miss next week's. Until then, hang in there, everyone. We're more than halfway through February now, my dears. Bye.